Thank you, everyone, for coming. My approach to weight loss is a very alternative approach. I guess a very holistic approach, which is why I'm here. And it's based on my own experience of having lost over 225 pounds. And the research that I've done and working with clients. I've also written a book on the subject, which was supposed to be here, but apparently the box got sent back to Australia. I'm not exactly sure why. But if you're interested in the book, there's an order form, and we can get it to you without any shipping costs. So, so what I want to do is just tell you a little bit about my approach. Is basically, you know, yesterday I was in this same room, and Gladys was here. It was incredible. Incredible class, and one of the things she said was that, you know, your body is consciousness. Your fingers, your thumb cells know that they're thumb cells. Your nose cells know that they're nose cells, and that's something that I believe wholeheartedly. I believe that our bodies are consciousness, and it's almost like the way I look at it is that consciousness can exist in three phases, the same way that water exists in three phases. You know, water exists as it can be a solid as ice, or a liquid as water, or a gas. And to me, that's the same as consciousness. You know, consciousness in a physical form, in a solid form, is our body. Consciousness in a liquid form is our emotions. And consciousness in a mental form, or in a gaseous form, is our mind. And this is the same consciousness that just travels into different phases. And so your thoughts and your feelings affect your body to an incredible extent, and that's definitely been my experience. And what I've found with myself is that your body knows exactly what weight you are, and whatever weight you are, you're that weight for a specific reason, because fat has a purpose. Fat protects us from our environment, if need be. It doesn't always do it, but sometimes it protects us. So our bodies use fat as a form of protection. And if you want to lose weight, what you have to do is try to understand why your body is using fat as a form of protection and what you have to do in order to get it to stop doing that. So if your body wants to use fat as a form of protection, then what it's going to do is it's going to want to be fat. And this was my experience. And if you want to lose weight, what you have to do is get your body to want to be thin. And when your body wants to be thin, weight loss becomes automatic. And so what I want to do is just tell you about my own experience a little bit and then tell you about some of the research I did. And then maybe we can do something really practical, because I want to see if I can give you something that you can take to your clients, you know, that you can use in your practice. So just to tell you about myself, I used to be pretty thin. I was pretty much the same when Daphne knew me in school. And around 1990, I moved up to New York and started working on Wall Street. And from the moment I moved up there, I started gaining weight. And in the beginning, I didn't think much about it. You know, I gained 10 pounds, 20 pounds the first year, and my friends were teasing me, and, you know, it was a funny thing. And the second year, I gained about the same. And then it stopped being funny, you know. So I gained about 50 pounds, and that's all right. Is it for me? You saw my calling back. And so I started trying to lose weight. I started going on diets, and basically, what would happen is I'd go on a diet. And every diet was the same. There'd be a list of things that you can't have and things that you can't have and things that you're counting and good days and bad days and all this kind of stuff. And I'd go on a diet and I'd start losing weight. I'd lose maybe 5 or 10 pounds. And I'd be really, you know, disciplined and focused. And then, you know, I'd start having these cravings for all these things I couldn't have. And when you live in New York, you know, I mean, every block has just smells that are just driving you crazy. I mean, they've got the best pizza in the universe. And, you know, you just can't walk outside without being assaulted with these smells. And just sooner or later, I just couldn't take it anymore. And I have a bad day, and I just binge. And then I'd be off my diet. And then whatever I lost, if I lost 10 pounds over like a 3 or 4 week period, within 2 weeks that 10 pounds was back. And then in another week, another 5 pounds came on. So then I was all of a sudden 5 pounds heavier. And I did this for several years, where basically going on diets and just dieting my way up and up and up and up, where I'd lose weight, I'd lose 10 pounds, I'd gain 15 pounds, lose 10 pounds, gain 15 pounds. And when I say I worked with everyone, you know, I did everything I could. I worked with Dr. Atkins, you know, face-to-face in New York, spent several thousand dollars with him, $3,000 or $4,000, and a month's time working face-to-face with him, and tests, blood tests, and everything he was doing with me. And in the end, he just looked at me, and he basically yelled at me, you know, and said, "You're killing yourself. What are you doing?" And I'm looking at this guy, and I'm thinking, you know, you crotchety old man, you know. I said, "Is that the best you can do, you know? You're Dr. Atkins, and I just spent $3,000 with you, you know? And do you think I'm going to lose weight because you're mad at me? You know, that's going to motivate me somehow? How you feel about this situation? Like, I'm not doing everything I can already?" And then I spent a couple weeks at Pritikin, the Pritikin Institute. And my wife used to joke with me that I was on the Atkins diet during the day and the Pritikin diet at night. Which is like, you know, the Atkins is like no carbs. And then by the end of the day, you know, I just couldn't take it anymore. The Pritikin diet is all carbs and no protein, you know. So I was on the Atkins diet during the day and the Pritikin diet at night. And, you know, eventually I got to be over 400 pounds. And I have a picture here somewhere. Hold on. Oh, that's hide. How do I unhide it? Oh. If now it's not good. Oh, you know what happened? My computer probably doesn't even look like it's plugged in. I had a picture.
There's one right here that's disconnected.
Oh, this is what happened. All right, you'll have to wait for the picture. Let me hide this because that's just going to... Yes, I'm A+. I'll tell you something, I can't go a day without eating meat, so I'm not sure. Okay. So I don't have too much confidence in the blood type diet. One of the many diets I've tried. But what happened was, I got to be over, like I said, I got to be over 400 pounds. And I had sort of an epiphany. I had sort of an epiphany. I remember I was driving in my car in New Jersey on the way to New York City. Just around River Edge, and as I'm driving, I said, "You know what? For whatever reason, my body wants to be fat." You know, and the minute I had that realization, I just pulled over, and I just sat along the exit, and I just thought about that. I said, "You know, here I am killing myself to try to lose weight and forcing myself to lose weight when this was never really a big issue for me. I mean, it was at one point, but." It wasn't a huge issue for me. And here I was killing myself to try to lose weight, and it just kept gaining and gaining. And I said, you know, if I don't figure out why my body wants to be fat, there's no point in dieting. There's no point in trying to kill myself to lose weight. So so I decided right then and there, this was back in 2001, I decided right then and there I was never going to diet again. And I never have. And instead, what I did was I decided that I'd try to figure out why my body wanted to be fat in the first place and what I could do to get my body to want to be thin. And I started researching in that direction. And basically, I thought a lot about it. And I said, you know, why would someone's body want to be thin, or why would it want to be fat? You know, why any of these things? And I thought about, well, what's the whole purpose of fat? And, you know, as you know, I mean, fat once served a very important purpose. It kept us alive during times of famine. And in cold weather, it kept us warm. So fat served an important purpose. But then I realized that, you know, if you're in a famine, okay, those people that can hold on to fat really well, those people are going to survive. But having lots of fat on you is only good in a famine. You know, and we've lived in lots of different environments. So if you're in a different environment, fat can kill you. It can put you at risk. If you're living in an environment, let's say, where it's warm and it's tropical, and you can have all the food you want, so you don't really need fat. But at the same time, there's saber-toothed tigers chasing you. Then having even 1 ounce of fat on your body can mean life and death to you. You could die if you have any fat on you, if you're living in that environment. And we've lived in all types of environments. You know, we were able to populate the world. And the key to survival in living in all these different environments is for our body to gauge the right amount of fat that we should have for any one living environment. You don't want to be so fat that you can't run away from a tiger, and you don't want to be so thin that you can't survive a famine. So each environment has its own unique stresses. And our body is able to adapt to those stresses and decide what weight it wants to be. You know, you look at an Eskimo and then you look at an Ethiopian, and they're naturally a very different weight. And that's because it's a different stress. So each of these environments, as I'm saying, have a different stress to them. If you're living in a famine, that's a specific type of stress. It's going to cause a specific type of chemical reaction in your body. And our bodies are programmed to respond to that chemical reaction by going into a type of fat storage, by holding on to fat, and by lowering the metabolism, by having cravings for fattening foods and all this type of stuff. But then if you're living in that in the other environment that I'm talking about, where it's always warm and there's always food, like a tropical paradise or something, but you've got to run away from tigers, so you've got to stay thin, that's a different type of stress. Running away from a tiger is a different type of stress than being in a famine. It's not all fight or flight response. You know, people think that stress, so it's the fight or flight response. And everything's just a variation of the fight or flight response. Running away from a tiger is a fight or flight response. And by the way, I thought about this also, you know, when you're running away from a tiger, you don't have to be faster than the tiger in order to escape. You just have to be faster than the guy next to you who's running also. Right? So you know, nice knowing you, Bill. You know, like, that's the fight. What's that? I can't help it. It's ruthless, but it's true. So that's the fight or flight response. Okay, when you're running away from a tiger, that's the fight or flight response, and it's the HPA axis, and it's all of these things that we all know. Okay, but if you're 3 months into a famine in an ice age, and it's just going on and on and on, where you're cold all the time and there's barely enough food, that's stress, but it's not the fight or flight response. It's a different type of stress that causes a different chemical reaction in your body. Okay, so as we know today, we don't have famines and we don't have ice ages. None of us here. When was the last time any of us experienced a famine or an ice age? We don't have it here, okay? For all the people that care about weight loss, okay, and the people that live, there's no famines, there's no ice age, and there's no tigers. So none of this applies. Okay, we don't have to be fat or we don't have to be thin in this living environment. That whole program that we have and all the chemical reactions and all this stuff doesn't apply. But as you know, we still have stress. I mean, that's all we've been hearing about all week, is stress. But the important thing to understand is that stress does not necessarily just mean the fight or flight response. Sometimes stress is the fight or flight response. And when it is, our bodies are programmed to do certain things. And one of them is actually to get thinner. Because this fight or flight response actually makes your body more sensitive to leptin. And leptin, I'm sure you all know, is really the master hormone when it comes to weight loss. Leptin controls your hunger. It controls the type of foods you crave. It has an influence on your metabolism and on your liver as far as fat burning and fat storage. So if you're resistant to leptin, you're craving foods, you're hungry all the time, you're craving very sweet foods, your metabolism slows down, and your liver goes into fat storage. And I have to tell you, when you look at people that look like that, okay, they're not weak, and they're not lazy, and they're not overindulgent. Their bodies want to be fat. They're leptin resistant, and there is nothing they can do about it as far as making an effort. And as a matter of fact, the person who discovered leptin, I think his name's Jeffrey Friedman, you know, when he really understood this, and he said that this whole concept that you can lose weight through willpower is inappropriate. And someday I'm going to ask for an apology from the medical community, because I can't tell you how many doctors I've gone into their office, you know, and the first thing they do is they just give you that look, you know? You know, I don't know if you know that look. Like,
I know that look from the inside, and I think I've overcome it fairly successfully.
Yeah.
But from the doctor's side, that look is actually a feeling of despair.
Yeah.
It's a, oh my God, what am I as doctor? I mean, so many doctors are eye focused, and you know, their job is to make this person well, and they say, oh no, here's a heart attack.
That may be true. That may be true, and it's certainly true in your case. But I know from being on the other side of it, what I'm projecting when I see that look, and from all the people that I've talked to, that look is, you know, you don't give a shit about your body. You know, you're just lazy, and you know, you want me to give you a pill to fix you, and you don't want to do the slightest bit to help yourself. That's what I see, and that's what I've seen all in so many doctors that I've gone to, is that look. And I want to tell you, you know, as healers, that when someone comes into your office looking like that, if you even think that, you have lost them as a patient. You will not be able to help them. Because 99% of communication is nonverbal. And people know that you're feeling, you're thinking that. And they know that you have no idea what they're going through. Because they are trying. I had fitness trainers, and as I said, I had Atkins and all of these things, you know. And I was a very disciplined person. You know, I was running three companies at the same time. One of them was during the day. I was chairman of a brokerage company during the day. I was president of a startup municipal bond company, online trading company, and I had an overnight futures trading company. So I used to wake up every 2 hours to check the markets. I was a very disciplined person. But when your body wants to be fat, there is nothing you can do about it, because you can control the amount of food that you eat for a little bit, for a little while. But hunger is an unconscious process, the same way the urge to breathe or having your heartbeat is unconscious. It's not part of your control. Okay, so you cannot control how hungry you are, and you can't control the types of foods that you're craving, and you can't control your metabolism, and you can't control how efficient you are at burning fat. That's the domain of your body, and if your body wants to be fat, it can do all of these things simply by tuning a dial. All it has to do is become a little bit more insensitive to leptin, just like tuning a dial. And once it does that, all of these things happen. And when it wants to be thin, on the flip side, all it has to do is tune the dial a little bit so that it starts listening to leptin. When it listens to leptin, you're just not as hungry. You don't crave sweets anymore. Your metabolism speeds up, and you become very efficient at burning fat. So it just becomes automatic. The question is, how do you get your body to listen to leptin? Well, what I started doing when I made this realization is I stopped studying obesity. And I used to study on the computer probably about 3 or 4 hours a day, sometimes more. And I had a little bit of a biology background at Penn. I took a lot of biology courses. I took organic chemistry, and I did a year of biochemistry just because I was really interested in the subject. It wasn't my major. But it gave me enough of a background to go on to the internet and do and research things. What I did was I stopped studying obesity, and I started studying starvation, because I wanted to see what the chemical changes are in the body when your body goes into starvation. And so what I did was, I call it the famine and temperature stress response. Famine, temperature meaning cold temperature, but it's a cute little kind of acronym for fat, the fat stress response. These are the types of things that happen when you're in a famine for a prolonged period of time. These are some of the chemical changes that take place in the body. And so I'm just wondering, if you're looking at this, okay, forget about the last two for a second, because we'll talk about them. You probably don't see those too often. But if somebody showed you this chemical profile, you know, and they said, what's wrong with this person? Increased cortisol levels, increased triglycerides, insulin resistance. And I say possibly increased levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines like tumor necrosis alpha, interleukin 6 and C-reactive protein. I say possibly because the data is very sketchy about pro-inflammatory cytokines in FAS. Some say they're elevated, some say they're not. So I say possibly on that one. But someone comes into you with that chemical profile, metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome is the starvation stress response. That's what metabolic syndrome is. It's a starvation stress response. In other words, some type of stress, some mental or emotional or physical stress, and we'll try to talk about this. And incidentally, anything that I don't cover here is in my book if you're interested. So I'll try to rush through and cover as much as I can. But some type of stressor, is activating the famine stress response. So this person comes into your office and he's 400 pounds and he's got his Slurpee and he smells of McDonald's and all this kind of stuff and you're thinking all these things. And the one thing you're probably not thinking is that this guy's starving to death. This guy's body has been tricked somehow through some sort of stress into thinking that he's starving. And no matter how much he eats, because the stress is not coming from starvation. See, if you really are starving and all these things happen, your cortisol levels go up and your triglycerides go up and all, you become insulin resistant, then when you finally eat, the stress goes away and all this goes away. But if the stress is coming from somewhere else, you can eat 5,000 calories, 10,000 calories, it doesn't matter. Your body still thinks it's starving. And that's what causes morbid obesity. Your body is perpetually in starvation mode, no matter how much you eat or no matter how fat you get. And it is a living hell. But what happens then is you go to the doctor and your body's already being tricked into thinking it's a time of famine already, okay, through whatever stress it's going on. And you go to the doctor, and what does he tell you to do? Eat less. So your body's already being tricked into famine, and then you start eating less. It only increases all of these problems. Your cortisol levels even go up even higher. Triglycerides go up even higher. All these things happen. So it's the worst. It's the worst type of advice you can give in that situation. And that's why I say someday, I'm looking for an answer, an apology from the medical community. For so many people, when they say your problem is you eat, it's just calories in, calories out. I have heard that from so many different doctors. Just calories in, calories out, and the problem is you eat too much. And they're just not looking at the subtlety of the situation. And so people are struggling and struggling to try to lose weight, and they're going the wrong way. You know what it's like? One day, I remember I was writing in my office, and my cat brought a bird into the office, caught a bird and brought it into the office. And so I grabbed it, I shook it loose, and the bird flew away. It flew into the window, and it's trying to go out a closed window. And it's just pounding against this window, because it makes sense. It looks like it should be able to get out. Yeah. About what? This bird that I'm talking about? Okay. I'm not the only one who's come up with this, but this is definitely what's happening. But as far as just going back to the bird for a second, is that sometimes you're just pushing against this direction. You're pounding your head against this direction because it makes sense, right? It makes sense that if you're too fat, that you should eat less. That makes sense. But if that worked, we wouldn't have an obesity epidemic. And there wouldn't be a new diet coming out every single, day of the week, right? There'd be a diet. One diet. That's it. You go on the diet. You lose weight. Everybody loses weight. This is the diet. There's no problems. And that'd be the end of it. But that's not the reality. And the reason is, because in the first place, your body wants to be fat because it's being tricked into thinking that it needs the weight to keep you alive. So it's fighting for your life. Your body's being tricked into thinking it's starving to death. Okay? So the bird's doing fine. I got the bird out the other window. And it's lived happily ever after. And my other cat caught it one day and ate it, but I'm not going to get into that because sooner or later it happens to all of us. So I just wanted to go through some... of these things and talk about them for a second, and how they affect leptin and why it makes your body want to be fat. I'll try to do that pretty quickly. Cortisol, the relationship between cortisol and leptin resistance is just very clear cut. You've heard, you know, Cushing syndrome, when cortisol levels rise. If you give someone cortisol medication, they just get fatter and fatter. They get more and more leptin resistant. So, but the thing about cortisol is that not everybody that's overweight has elevated cortisol levels. But they actually do. They just have them in their fat cells. And we'll talk about this. There's a certain hormone, this hormone here, enzyme, the 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase type 1. It converts inactive cortisone into active cortisol in the omentum of your fat cells. What it does is it creates sort of a Cushing syndrome in your fat cells.
Can you say again what that does?
It converts inactive cortisone into cortisol. So, and that's not going to show up in a blood test or saliva test or urine test. But these people all have, studies have shown that this enzyme is very, very active in all obese people. And some people are calling obesity Cushing syndrome of the omentum. And the relationship between leptin resistance and this particular enzyme is very clear cut because studies in mice, when they hyperactivate this enzyme, you get obesity and leptin resistance and all these things. If they take the enzyme out or genetically engineer the mouse so that he doesn't have that enzyme, he doesn't gain weight. Yeah. So that doesn't show up. So cortisol is a big player in leptin resistance. And in starvation as well as in obesity, this enzyme is very, very highly expressed. It's just people don't really know too much about it right now. But that's there. No one's testing for it. Increased triglycerides, okay? What triglycerides do, there was a study that came out in 2004 where triglycerides will bind with leptin and prevent it from crossing the blood-brain barrier. So the hypothalamus gets an inaccurate assessment of how much leptin is in the body, so it doesn't really know how fat you actually are. So that causes a type of leptin resistance. So that's why lowering triglycerides is a very, very crucial factor. All of these things, you know, like if I were testing, you know, I'm not a doctor, but if I were testing people, I would really be focusing on triglycerides and actually all of these things that I'm talking about. Insulin resistance, yeah. I would have to assume so. Yeah. Anytime there's elevated cortisol levels, you're going to have elevated triglycerides, I think, because that's what cortisol does, is it frees up triglycerides into the bloodstream, among other things. Insulin resistance, you know, what happens with insulin resistance obviously is you get hyperinsulinemia. And hyperinsulinemia, there's a couple of nuances about it. I know you guys all know more about it than I do, but there's a couple of nuances about it as far as weight goes. When you have hyperinsulinemia, you basically lose the ability to burn fat efficiently because one of the things that insulin does is it suppresses glucagon and lipolytic enzymes. And it does that obviously intentionally because you're in fat storage mode, not fat burning mode. So when you have hyperinsulinemia, the whole time, you're not able to burn fat. And people don't really consider that either when they go on a diet. You know, don't eat this, don't eat that, calories in, calories out. Do you have the ability to even burn fat? You know, and if your insulin levels are high enough, you have lost the ability to burn fat. So the other thing that insulin does is it activates the expression of the SOX3 gene, suppressor of cytokine signaling 3 gene in the hypothalamus. And as far as leptin goes, when you activate it in certain areas, the paraventricular nucleus and I forget the other one because it's been a while since I did the research, but when you do that, it prevents the downstream signaling, which communicates with the thyroid and your liver and all those things. So that's how leptin resistance happens. One of the mechanisms of leptin resistance is to activate the SOX3. So insulin will do that. So when you have high insulin levels, that's going to create more leptin resistance, and then you get this vicious cycle. You know, your leptin, your insulin levels are up. you have leptin resistance. You gain more weight. That creates your insulin levels to go even higher and even more leptin resistance. And leptin also does the same thing. Leptin will also activate the SOX3, so you get this vicious cycle.
Can you spell what you're saying?
SOX, SOC3, suppressor of cytokine signaling. Yeah. Pro-inflammatory cytokines. Tumor necrosis alpha, which you do also, very often see, and C-reactive protein, which you do often see in metabolic syndrome. That to me is the one thing that I would zero in on more than anything, because tumor necrosis alpha activates this 11B HSD1 enzyme. It causes insulin resistance, and it activates the SOX3 gene. So it's like from one chemical control does all of these things. So if I were testing someone and I saw elevated levels of tumor necrosis alpha and C-reactive protein, I would say that all of these things are happening. And that's something that needs to be zeroed in. So it's an inflammatory cytokine. So that's where inflammation, that's why people are talking about now that obesity is, you know, a disease of inflammation, because they found so much correlation between obesity and these pro-inflammatory cytokines. And if you think about it kind of metaphorically or symbolically, which I always do, what is inflammation? I mean, inflammation is a swelling of an area to protect an injury, you know? So if you look at it, you know, if there's a, metaphorically, there's an injury, some hurt, you know? As far as the body is trying to understand it, you know, there's a swelling, you know, an inflammation, an inflammatory response. That's something that could be happening. And that's another thing I want to talk about right now as far as stress goes. Besides the fact that we always think that, every time we think of stress, we think of the fight-or-flight response, and everything's just a variation of the fight-or-flight response. And I've even heard how, you know, it's a big thing that how cortisol, you know, makes you fat. That came out a few years, about in 2001, and that was all the buzz. Cortisol makes you fat. And they described it as this. Well, you're in stress all the time, so you've got this fight-or-flight response going on all the time. That creates cortisol in your body. And in the old days, you ran away from a tiger, and then you needed to recharge and go eat somewhere. And the cortisol made you eat, and all of these things, and that's what caused the obesity. I don't think that's right. The reason I don't think that's right is because the fight or flight response causes leptin sensitivity, because corticotropin releasing hormone, which you know, the fight or flight response starts with corticotropin releasing hormone. Okay, that increases leptin sensitivity. And what you find in starvation and in obesity is elevated levels of corticotropin-releasing hormone binding protein. And what that does is it binds to corticotropin-releasing hormone and inhibits its ability to do its job. So it's like the body saying, no, we're trying to be leptin resistant now, we don't want to be leptin sensitive. And just to, you know, just to further emphasize my point about how I see leptin, how sensitive you are or how resistant you are to leptin, as an intentional act on the body when the body wants to or needs to be fat or wants to be thin, sunlight, okay, increases leptin sensitivity. And the reason it does is because melanocortins do something, I don't remember because it's been a while, but in the hypothalamus to increase leptin sensitivity. But if you were a Siberian hamster, sunlight would cause leptin resistance. So it's the exact same stress, but organism, it's causing leptin sensitivity, and in another, it's causing leptin resistance. Siberian hamsters when Siberian hamsters are exposed to sunlight, that means they need to stock up on food and get as fat as possible so that they can hibernate. For us, it means that the winter's over, and there's going to be food, and it's warm, and all of these things. So it's the same stress. One being, it's causing sensitivity, another, it's resistance. So the body, it's a beautiful, brilliant mechanism that the body can use anytime it wants to be fat or wants to be thin. But also, getting back to stress, that the other thing we always focus on in stress, besides it just being the fight or flight response, is we only focus on the way our body reacts to it, not the way our body adapts to it. Because there's three things that happen when you have stress. One, your body has to interpret the stress. What is it? Is it a tiger? If it's a tiger, what do? Your body has to react to the stress. Run away as fast as you can. Your body then has to adapt to the stress. What do I do so that this stress becomes less stressful? You know, I think it was like Hans Selye said that when a stress is applied to a system in equilibrium, the system will adapt so as to make the stress less stressful. What do I do to adapt so that the stress is less stressful? Get thinner, get faster, get stronger, so that the next time the tiger chases you, you can escape. You know, again, you can run faster than the other guys, whatever. So your body interprets the stress, it reacts to it, and adapts to it. And we only focus on the reaction. We never focus on how the body is interpreting the stress. And how the body is interpreting the stress will determine how the body adapts to the stress. So you're driving along in the car, and you're late. And all of a sudden you start going, oh, fuck, I'm going to be late, my boss, stress, right? So how does your body interpreting that stress? Because it's going to interpret it. And this is where we get into the communication that I was talking about how your body is consciousness, the same way your mind is and your emotions. How is your body is always trying to help you. It wants to keep you safe. What's the threat when you're driving in the car? For some people, yeah, it's similar to a tiger. And so they're going to, you know, so their bodies are going to think it's the fight or flight response. Someone else, it might be something entirely different. And it's going to react entirely different. When I was working on Wall Street, I had a partner. And he was this very type A guy. And everything, all day, he was ranting and raving and cursing and flailing. You know, the fax machine doesn't work. Fuck! He'd go like this, and he'd throw the fax machine, and it would break, and he'd say, Bernard, I need another fucking fax machine right away. No. And this went on all day. And I would say to him, well, Dave, you know, Bernard's getting another fax machine, but next time that happens, if you press the little green button over there that says start, all of those buttons are going to light up. It's going to work again, you know? So this is going on all day. And I worked with this guy for 15 years. And the whole time, he just kept getting thinner and thinner. Yeah. He kept getting thinner and thinner. And I kept getting fatter because I was just taking it. So his body was like, when he's going like this, and fuck, his body's going, oh, shit, we got to run away. Something's happening. That's how his body's interpreting the stress. It was a fight or flight stress for him. I just sort of took it and got number. Like I was living in an Arctic wasteland. So that's how my body was interpreting it. It was a different type of stress. And it caused a different chemical response. So, and I think this has very broad applications. You know? Not just weight. This whole concept of how is your body interpreting stress, you know, to determine how your body's adapting it to it. It's not just, you know, this whole concept, and I keep harping on it, but I can't help it, I'm a little bit passionate about this whole concept, and I read all about it, it's a fight or flight response. It just comes from a very kind of mechanistic, Newtonian science, age of science, when the body was just this machine, you know, that needed another piece, and you could take something out. What? You don't need that? You know, your tonsils, take them out. You know, take this out. We don't need it. We'll sew you back together up. This is science. This is the age of science. You know, we're great. That's where it came from. But I think there needs to be another paradigm because your body has this consciousness. So, and I know this now from my own experience because I communicate to my body all the time now, and my body communicates back to me. And we do it in symbols, which is something I want to talk about a little bit. So I just want to talk now about what type of stresses might cause this fat stress response. Physical stresses, emotional stresses, and mental stresses. So physical stresses, well, we can start with dieting, as we talked about. Dieting is a physical stress that mimics a famine, and that's why diets don't work. So if diets don't work, what do you do? Well, this is what I did. And this is what I tell people to do, and it seems to work. It doesn't work instantly. It's not a miracle cure, but it does work. You add what's missing. Whatever you're eating now, eat it. Forget about it. Don't think about it. De-emphasize it. You want to eat it, eat it. When I started losing weight, I was eating chocolate. I kept chocolate almonds in my refrigerator, and I would walk by. If I wanted a piece of chocolate, I would just walk by. It was just chemicals in and chemicals out, because I was not dieting again. I was never going to diet again. So I didn't have good days. I didn't have bad days. I wasn't counting, you know, and then all of a sudden having this big binge, which I used to have. I once had 3 delivery people show up at my house at the same time. In New York, when I was living in New York. And it was so embarrassing, you know, they had to go like, I'll be with you in a second, guys, you know, having this big party, you know, like, you know, so that was a bad day, right? So there's a pizza guy, a Chinese guy, and they deliver McDonald's there, too, and they're all just standing there, you know.
We had 1-3 pizza guys.
So that was a bad day. So I didn't have bad days anymore, and I didn't have good days. I wanted the chocolate. I just walked by. It was chemicals in, chemicals out. That's all I saw it as. I de-emphasized it. But I never went a day without adding the things that I knew I needed, such as omega, and these are all things you know, so I'll go through it real quick a bit, such as omega-3 fatty acids. You know, and we're all chronically starving for that. So I never went a day without having a protein shake with ground flax seeds. I eat whatever I wanted, whenever I want, but I never went a day without it. So add. And then I started adding live food and, you know, all these things. So the types of things that we need that need to be added, omega-3s. Now, when you think, you hear a number of things about omega-3s. I'll just put my own spin on it. Inflammation, right? Pro-inflammatory cytokines. Like I say, I think pro-inflammatory cytokines are the trigger to this whole fat stress response. So taking omega-3s suppresses pro-inflammatory cytokines. So never, ever go one day. If there's a program to follow, never go a single day without omega-3s, ever. Because the other thing it does is, according to Dr. Ron Rosedale, it creates a more permeable membrane on our cells that allows for more efficient signaling than a saturated fat. A saturated fat's a hard, stiff fat, and this is a more permeable fat. So that allows more effective signaling, which also helps take care of insulin resistance. So omega-3s, I never go a day without them. And the other thing that happens is over time, it's an overtime type of thing. You know, it's not just a miracle cure pill. You take one pill. So in six months from now, all of your cells are going to have that more permeable membrane, and you're going to start being able to burn fat more efficiently. And that's what happened with me. I didn't lose fat quickly in the beginning. I was eating whatever I wanted, and then maybe in the first 6 months, I lost 25, 30 pounds. Not very much for someone who weighs over 400 pounds. But I wasn't dieting, and I was losing weight. I ate whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. But I never went a day without adding certain things. But what happened, which is different than a diet, is that the longer I was doing this, the faster I started losing weight. And I've never heard of that with a diet. You know, with a diet, you hear 6 months, oh, I lost 50 pounds in 50 days. Don't I look great? And then, you know, no one sees where you are 6 months later. You know? I lost the weight slowly in the beginning. It went faster and faster. The last 25 pounds that took me down to about 183 pounds, something like that, I lost that weight in 6 weeks or something. 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Just flew off of me. And I've been the same weight for 3 years now. And I've never dieted. It's just that my body's very efficient at burning fat. And my body doesn't want to be fat. Doesn't need to be fat anymore. So adding what's missing is really important. Water, we're starving for water. Okay. Oxygen, this is a really important point. When someone's really heavy, okay, the likelihood of them having sleep apnea is very, very high. It's just a mechanics thing. When your weight's heavy, when your neck is heavy enough, it cuts off your windpipe. Sleep apnea increases cortisol levels. So it's a very vicious cycle. You gain a certain amount of weight, and then you get sleep apnea. Then your cortisol levels go up, which increases your insulin resistance and your leptin resistance. And you're also exhausted all the time. And that causes you to crave junk food. It's a vicious, vicious cycle. I don't think you can lose weight, in my opinion, when you're morbidly obese without taking care of sleep apnea. It wasn't until I got a CPAP machine. When I went in to get my sleep study for sleep apnea, it was the first night's sleep I had gotten in I don't know how many years. They stopped me after 2 hours. They stopped me. I had 83 apneas. And 173 mini apneas in a 2-hour period. And they said, okay, that's enough. You've got sleep apnea. They fitted me. my blood oxygen level. This is what I remember, and in retrospect, it sounds pretty incredible. My blood oxygen levels was in the 50s. So I got the CPAP machine. It was the first good night's sleep I had in I don't know how many years. I actually had a dream again. I've forgotten that when you sleep, you dream. It's kind of symbolic, you know, like a dream again. But, you know, so if you have someone that's morbidly obese, they have to get the sleep apnea taken care of. You know, there's just no way to pull yourself out of the situation without it. And then toxins. You know, that's all we talk about is toxins. And I'll just give you my own spin on that. Your body stores toxins because in your fat cells, because it's a chemical buffer and protects your body. So if you're taking in more toxins than you can eliminate, those toxins have to be stored somewhere. And your body stores them in the fat cells. One study found that over 800 different chemicals in your fat cells. So you have to make an effort to detoxify some way. For me, I'm very pro wheatgrass juice. I think that's a brilliant type of thing. Which reminds me, the other thing I think we're starving for is vitality. You know, I used to. I remember when I lived in New York, I'd have winters where I didn't see the sun at all because I'd go to work when it was still dark and I'd come back when it was dark. And all the food I ate was just dead, devitalized food. So your body's starving for vitality. We need life. There's a tremendous difference between a dead piece of food and a live piece of food, the same way there's a difference between a dead body and a live body. That life, we assimilate that life. So adding live foods, and it's just adding. Don't become a live food vegan, just add. Add live foods. One thing I like to tell people is whatever you're eating, make a salad out of it. You want to eat pizza? Fine. Cut it up. Put it in a big salad with lots of lettuce and sprouts and anything else that's live. It gets you in the habit of eating salads. It also helps you chew slower so that you're not eating as much. It gives you digestive enzymes. You know, so and you start really liking live foods. And the other thing is digestion, which we talked about a lot. You know, if you're not digesting your food, then it's a form of starvation, really. So you could be eating all the calories you want, but you're not getting the nutrients. So making a point of probiotics and digestive enzymes and all these things that you guys know a lot more about than I do. So those are some physical stresses that can activate the fat stress response and put your body in this sort of perpetual fat storage mode. And then I have some mental and emotional stresses that I know from my own experience and from talking and counseling with a lot of people, and I've given them little names like mental starvation. Okay, when you're going, you know, let's say that, and you can be starving, or rather, let's take a step back. Emotional starvation. That's what I want to talk about. Okay, if you're starving for love, meaning, purpose, all of these things, it's a form of starvation. Your body, remember, is trying to interpret the stresses in your life, and all it hears is you're starving for something. So, and it wants to help because it's a stress. It wants to keep you safe. It doesn't understand that it's not a physical stress. So what's its reaction? For some people, it's to activate this fat stress response. Say you're worried about money all the time. I remember when I first moved to New York, I was working as a bond trading assistant, and I was making $300 a week, and my rent was $400 a week. So if you're worried about money all the time, money's a resource. And you're worried that resources are limited. Now, to your body, there's only one resource that it can save, and that's fat. So if your body is trying to interpret the stresses in your life, and you're worried about resources all the time, it's going to react that way. It can. And studies have shown that people that are worried about money all the time or in very low-income situations, statistically, they're more likely to gain weight and to have metabolic syndrome. If you think about it, they should lose weight because they don't have as much money to eat, right? But no, you know, they gain weight because, what's that?
It's not the crappy diet they're eating.
Yeah, well, it is the crappy diet they're eating, but they're eating the crappy diet because their bodies want to be fat. In other words, when I was in New York, I ate a really crappy diet. And now I don't. I have one of the healthiest diets in the world. But I still eat whatever I want, whenever I want. It's just my body wants very healthy things. When I remember also, when I was in New York, if I went if I missed a meal, I would panic. Like, where am I going to get my food? And I was talking to this guy that I've been counseling in Australia, Graham, and he's as big as I was, and he's just starting to lose weight now. And he's listening to, by the way, my book has a CD, a visualization CD, because visualization, as I'm going to talk about in a second, is really effective. So he's been listening to the CD, and he's losing weight. He's lost 20 pounds already, and he's really excited. And the one thing he said to me is, if I missed a single meal, I would panic. And I know that feeling. And what was going on with him is that his body, and with me, his body was needed to be fat. And now it doesn't anymore. And so it's not panicking. And so yesterday, I remember, I had that omelet that we had, And that was in the morning, and I realized the end of the day or the next day that I hadn't eaten the rest of the day. And I wasn't dieting or anything. I mean, I was chewing on apples, but I wasn't thinking about it. It's because this is where my body wants to be right now. So those are that's what I call emotional starvation. And then I have something I call emotional obesity, which is different than emotional starvation, and it's different than emotional eating. And it's really the most important one when you're dealing with morbid obesity. Emotional obesity is the need to be fat in order to feel safe. And you can add all the omega-3s you want and all the probiotics and, put them on a training thing, a treadmill for 50 hours a day. And if you've got emotional obesity, that person's going to stay fat. I had emotional obesity. I felt safer being thin. That partner I told you about, that flails its arms. He worked like on a desk like here. He sat here, and I sat here. And he was always angry and always pissed off. And I was afraid of him. I did not feel safe around him. He was bigger than me. He was taller. He was almost a pitcher in a professional baseball player. He was a big guy. And he reminded me of a kid. When I was a kid, I used to get beaten up by someone like that. And so it triggered all this stuff. I did not feel safe around him. But as I started gaining weight, I started feeling safer. Eventually, I was twice his weight, twice his size. I could sit on him. But if I ever tried to lose weight, I panicked. I didn't feel safe. But that's a stress, and my body was reacting to that stress in such a way to make me feel safer. And it got the cue for me that I felt safer. I spoke to a lady I've been on a couple of shows in Australia, and after the first one I did, this lady called me, and people have a tendency to just tell me things that they've never told anyone. And in Australia, they don't talk about any of their problems. In the States, everyone's like, I have a problem. I'm next. And they love Dr. Phil there because they're like, I would never do that in a million years. They're so fascinated with it. So maybe it's because I'm American. I don't know. But people will call me, and they'll tell me things they have never told anyone. So this lady calls me up, and she goes, she said, when I was a kid, and she's tried every diet in the world, and the same whole thing. And so she said, when I was a kid, I was abused by a babysitter. And it was actually a female babysitter for 3 years. And the whole time she was being abused, she was gaining weight. Eventually, she got so fat that her babysitter said, oh, my God, you're so fat, and left her alone. That made such an indelible impression on her that fat equals safety. That there's nothing that you could do as far as diet. If you try to lose weight when you're in that situation, your body is fighting for your life. It thinks it's acting in your best interest, and you curse it and all these things. But your body's fighting for your life. And I just had another girl call me after she's been emailing me after a seminar that I gave up in Perth. And I could all already feel when she was emailing me, I'm trying this and it's working, and the yummy protein shakes and all this stuff, and you're the best, and nothing else has worked, and you're so brilliant, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, thanks. And she gave me these weekly updates. And I know that she's just being a little bit too rah-rah about the subject. And finally she goes, I get an email, I'm losing weight. And then the next one, and I look great, my clothes are falling off of me. And then the next one I get is that, I had a bad week. People told me I looked great, and I started to panic. And I said, okay, give me a call. I just emailed her back, just call me, because I knew what was happening. And I said, look, a lot of people have had situations. You don't have to tell me what your situation was, but where things have happened. And then, sure enough, she was assaulted as a teenager. And so she doesn't feel comfortable being attractive. That weight's keeping her safe. It's protecting her from predators. But it's keeping her safe. So I said, you know, let's stop talking about all these yummy protein shakes. You know, you've got to deal with these this issue. So emotional obesity needs to be dealt with. Emotional obesity is 99% of it. Now, like Daphne, you said in your talk yesterday, you still have to repair the damage. You know, so you have to address the digestive system and the fact that the body's starving and all these things. You still have to do all those other things. But you will only be as successful as your ability to address the emotional obesity. And then I have what I call mental obesity. And again, all these things are in the book, and I'm rushing through it fast. But mental obesity is when your thoughts, you know, like I say, we've got our thoughts, our consciousness, our emotions are a liquid form of consciousness, our body's a physical form of consciousness. They all interact. So your thoughts affect your body, and I can't tell you how real that is for me in my life. So, you know, if you think it's impossible to lose weight, and you sort of, you know, that's why yesterday I was in here with Gladys, and one of the guys, I think it was Jan, said, you know, doctors sometimes come up and go, oh, you will not recover. You know, our thoughts have such an enormous impact on our body. And I know this so totally. And I'll just tell you why. Because the other thing that I recommend completely to everyone from day one, in addition to adding foods, is visualization. The visualization worked for me because the body that I have now is exactly the body I visualized having when I was over 400 pounds. I mean, exactly. And one day it happened. Every night as I was going to sleep, and I did learn that from you. That's my Aunt Carol. She came in. I learned visualization. That's my Aunt Carol. I learned visualization from her when I was a kid. But anyway, every night as I was going to sleep, I'd have a visual image of how I wanted it to look. Just took a second, but I saw it exactly. And one day it exactly happened. And anyone that saw that image when I was 400 pounds would say, you're crazy. You're dreaming. Which I was. I was dreaming. But why does visualization work so well? I thought a lot about this. And so remember when I was talking about how your body is interpreting the stress? Visualization is a way to communicate with your body. Because your body doesn't really speak English. It doesn't understand. You know, you say, I want to lose 20 pounds to look good for my friend's wedding so I can fit in a wedding dress in 6 months. Your body doesn't understand 6 months. It doesn't understand a wedding. It doesn't understand a wedding dress. It doesn't understand looking good. It doesn't understand English. It doesn't communicate in English. But you can communicate with anyone with symbols. You know, the same way when you're in an airport and it's got the picture for the toilet, you can speak any language and know that that's a toilet. It's a symbol. When you make a visual image, you're communicating with the consciousness of your body in symbols. And when you do it in like an alpha or a theta state, which the CD that I have puts you in, that's alpha and theta state, when you do it in that state, your brain's much more powerful. You know, because studies have shown the amplitude of your brain waves is more synchronous and it's higher, and based on all the chemical formulas for electricity and volts, it's like 1,000 times more powerful in the theta state. So the CD puts you in that theta state and prompts you to make a visual image. And I was able to do that anyway because I used to do a lot of meditation. So I'd go into that state and I'd create that visual image. And a lot of people talk about Deepak Chopra in his book, Seven Spiritual Laws of Success, talks about the law of pure potentiality and the law of intention. And he says, if you take an intention into the field of pure potentiality, you're able to manifest anything. And you get into that field of pure potentiality when your thinking stops. When your mind stops, you're in that field of pure potentiality. And the intention is the visualization. And one other way, like I said, I thought a lot about it. So one other analogy is if you're looking at a pool of water and you see, and there's no ripples, you can see your reflection perfectly. The second there's a ripple, it's all distorted. So our thoughts are like ripples in our mind-body experience. So when you have no thoughts and you make that visual image, your body understands that. And you can feel a difference. Sometimes I still, you know, when I make a visual image, I can feel like this thing that happens. It's like a ripple that happens through my body. It's almost like the cells are being reprogrammed. You can feel this. So I tell everybody to make a visual image. So if there's any like program, because it's not a diet or approach, but if there's any program that I have, it's one, adding everything that you're missing and addressing things like sleep apnea and things like that. The other is visualization. And you can use visualization for other things, for weight loss, which I did do. For example, you can use visualization to help eliminate food cravings. And Carol, it's really funny that you're here, because when I was 12 years old, I remember serving you a cup of coffee, and you didn't want sugar in it. And I said, how can you have coffee without sugar? That's disgusting. And she goes, well, I never eat sugar anymore. I can't stand the sight of sugar. I hate sugar. I go, why? And she said, well, what I used to do is I used to visualize sugar being ground glass. Ground glass.
That's harsh.
You did do this, though.
I know, that's a very harsh.
It has to be harsh, though, because it creates a visceral experience in your body. Because, your body doesn't understand the difference between real and imagined experiences. And you can take advantage of that. Just to repeat that, your body doesn't understand the difference between real and imagined experiences. So you visualize, when you're in that alpha or theta state, if you visualize taking some sugar and having it be ground glass and cutting up your organs. Right? Oh, God. You can't walk by a bakery without getting nauseous. And what I used to do is, I personally hate maggots. I don't know how much you like maggots, but I personally hate maggots, right? And so I used it to give up my addiction to wheat. And the way I did it was, as I was going to sleep at night, I imagined taking a bite of a sandwich. And all of a sudden, you know what I'm talking about? They're crawly. And you just feel it, and you imagine it to be real. And then you just create a very powerful negative association with it. So you can use visualization to give up food cravings. You can also use visualization to get the maximum benefit out of your exercising. Because what's the real benefit? Using this whole paradigm that I'm showing you, what's the real benefit of exercise? It's not really burning calories. And I used to go to the gym, and it would tell you'd be on this exercise machine for an hour, and you'd burn 300 calories, and you go, next time I just won't eat that bagel. I'm not going to get on the machine, right? It's very demoralizing. 300 calories is nothing, right? That's not the benefit of exercise, using this paradigm. What's the benefit of exercise?
How you feel and how you think of yourself.
Well, that is a benefit. But all those things. But using this overall paradigm, the real benefit of exercise is that it tricks your body into thinking you're living in a time of predators. And again, if your body thinks that you need to be thin in order to survive an attack, hold the blower, stop everything. Nothing's more important.
Should we
Let me tell you what I used to do. Because exercise already puts you in that kind of alpha, in an alpha state. When you're exercising, you get into a better, more programmable state. When I used to ride a bike up a hill, I would imagine that there was a dorsal fin following me. Only when I was going up the hill. The rest of the time, you're just exercising. You're just spinning. But every once in a while, even if someone's going for like a 40-minute walk, every once in a while, just for 30 seconds, you go all out, and you visualize that you are being chased by whatever it is that scares you. That's the benefit of exercise. And sometimes I even get a little bit lazy, and I just imagine that I'm exercising, and I'm running, and imagine, but it works. It works. If you imagine that you're exercising, you imagine that you're being chased by a predator, that works. What's that? 10 minutes for the whole talk? What happened to that 12? Oh, this? Okay. Okay. So anyway, we're almost done. So for me again, it was I visualized a dorsal fin because I'm not afraid of tigers. I love tigers, and I am afraid of sharks. I saw Jaws at a very impressionable age. And I had this experience, actually, where I spent the whole day on the beach. I was 10 years old. I spent the whole day on the beach. And they were saying, Johnny, cover yourself. I didn't listen. I had blisters on my shoulders that were so bad that my mom had to put cold cream this much just to get a shirt on. And so we're in this packed audience. I didn't even know where I was going to. I didn't know. It was just a movie. Everybody, packed audience. All of a sudden, the shark comes out. The lady behind me goes like this, digs her nails into my shoulders. And these blisters pop like packing bubbles. And then I couldn't take a bath for like another month after that. I mean, anytime I'm in the water, it could be any water. I just see my legs, going like this, and I hear the din, 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 din. So I'm afraid of sharks, right? So I'm going up the hill. So when I go for a bike ride, I'm relaxed. It's all just a spin. You're getting all those things, the oxygen, the feeling good, the endorphins, all those things, the circulation, the energy's flowing. But then I go up a hill, I stand up, I move as fast as I can, and I see that shark coming. And I visualize myself. Stomach muscles, perfect shape. And then you're getting the maximum benefit. That's because that's a real benefit of exercise. So we only have a couple minutes left. I apologize for that, because I missed the prompt for the 1 hour. So I'll open it up if anybody wants to ask any questions.
I'm astounded you don't have the skin just hanging on. Yeah.
I didn't pay you to ask that question. I've never been in a talk where people didn't ask that question. As I said, the body that I have now is exactly the body I visualized to have. Didn't visualize myself with loose skin.
You also said that you lost weight relatively slowly.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All these things. All these things are a factor. You know, we get into this discussion when I've done it. Like, if I say that I lost weight slowly, which I have said to people, they say, "Oh, how can you know you had a 60-inch waist? If you calculate the diameter of all it's impossible." So I stopped saying that. You know. So then I said, "Well, I was relatively young. I was 38. What do you mean?" Or I would say something, and they'd say, "No, you were young enough." So next time I'd say, "I was young enough," and they'd say, "You know, no, you weren't. What do you mean young enough? How can you do that?" So yeah, all those things came in, and the fact that I did it in a very, very healthy way. The other thing is I did it in a low stress way. When you diet, it elevates your cortisol levels. And cortisol causes your skin to become inelastic. Forcing yourself to diet or having surgery and crash losing weight over a six-month period, very, very stressful experience on your body. Your cortisol levels go up. Your skin becomes inelastic. So I didn't do any of that stuff.
That's right. You added.
I added. Yeah. Yeah. And the visualization, yeah.
And the life movement.
Yeah. Well, that's part. It's all in. Yeah. It's all in the book. And incidentally, I apologize. I mean, if anyone's interested in the book, I apologize for having books that were sent back to Australia. But Blair, you can order the book from Blair, and I can send it. It'll take about 2 weeks. Comes with a CD. It's $29.95. And I told him to waive the shipping costs. So, you know, well, it's the Gabriel Method, which, by the way, my name's John Gabriel Abrams, and it's in the book, and it's just going to be John Gabriel, the Gabriel Method, simple. That way, when I talk on the radio, it's see people can drive and they say John Gabriel, you know, Gabriel Method. It's easy to remember. So it's called the Gabriel Method. By John Gabriel.
Just Google that and you'll get
it. You can go. Well, if you just go to, let me just say, okay, the first version of the book came out as TOS, and that's the website's being updated. So the book you'll see, it's the same book, but it's called Total Transformation Weight Loss. If you go to, you can go to johngabriel.com.
With an H and
H. No H. Or John. Yes. Yeah.
And the increased cortisol. I mean, so if...
No. What is
the
increase?
Whole
no. You see, that's the thing. A fight or flight response, which I talked about earlier, is a positive stress as far as your body is concerned. Even though cortisol levels are elevated in the short term, in the long term, your cortisol levels go down, your triglycerides go down, because the fight or flight response has a negative feedback loop to it. CRH... goes to ACHT or whatever, adrenal corticoid, ACTH, and that increases to your glucocorticoids, that increases your cortisol level. But then cortisol inhibits CRH, so it's got a negative feedback loop. So it's not like having chronically elevated cortisol levels, and it certainly doesn't elevate your cortisol levels in your fat cells.
Well, there's just something about sort of visualizing this creature that you're really afraid of, and
yeah.
Everything about the law of attraction, everything.
That's a really good point. Now, that's a very valid point, and you don't have to do it. And I have had people say that. So far, I haven't gotten eaten by a shark.
Touch me.
Yeah. No, she's talking about something else, though. Yeah. Exactly.
It's when we create continuous
yes,
adrenal
that's
stress
right.
Well, that raises cortisol. That
I've heard that explanation, and I have a slightly different take on it, but maybe we can talk about. But what she's talking about is something else. What she's saying is the law of attraction.
Okay. Yeah.
Is when you know if you're thinking about visualizing, and it's a very valid point. And so if you don't want to do that, you don't have to. It's not a deal breaker. But what you can do while you're exercising is you can visualize your body in perfect shape while you're doing that sprinting.
I like that one.
Yeah, that works too. Paisley.
I have just taken the training myself. I have yet to teach my first course from a good psychologist that's devised a weight loss program on the same principle. And the website for that is mytruebody.com.
Okay, great. The truth shall be out there, shall be known. Great.
The same principles, and
great.
I'm fascinated now to get your book and get
the okay, great, great. So, do you know Blair, the guy who's running the bookstore, you can order it, and I'll have it to you. And wait, let me just have Daphne have the question.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could
fear is the shark, and you're offering, in a way, love to that shark. I mean, it's not really, you're not being chased by the way. You're doing something really positive in that moment, and you're incorporating all of that back into your body.
Yeah. I was trying to do is create a primal experience that I knew my body could connect with. Let's see.
My question is related to that. Just still on the shark thing.
Yeah.
Just one sort of last clarification.
I'll remember not to mention this next time.
You suggested that you're running.
Yeah.
And so the point is, you wouldn't suggest that if you weren't running. In other words, it's part of since you're moving.
Yeah. Oh, and that brings me. Yeah. And there's one other. Yeah. Yeah.
You,
yeah.
You wouldn't suggest someone before they
No. Just at that moment, that peak moment, and only for those 30 seconds that you're really, really moving. And that brings me to one other really important point. Say you're sitting at your office, and the stock market all of a sudden goes down or something, and you've got that stress. If you just get up and move for 30 seconds, you're communicating to your body that was a fight or flight stress. So it's a way to use something to your advantage. So that's one other thing I wanted to mention. But Eric, did you have a question?
There's some people, I forget where they were, but they did some research on appetite regulation in babies. And this was really, really interesting.
Mm.
Babies, infants, will regulate by metabolic need, metabolic demand.
Yeah.
They won't eat more than they need
to do
what they need to do metabolically until we teach them how to do that.
Until you put a lock on the refrigerator, which is what happened to me.
finish your plate.
Yeah.
We don't want to waste food. All these kind of messages which come from starvation times.
Yes.
So now we regulate by
The thinnest kids are the ones where their parents just don't even think about these things, and they're eating when they're eating, and that's it. You know, I actually am writing a book on childhood obesity, and that's a really, really kind of very passionate theme of mine is the things that we're doing to screw up our kids on a mental level. Yeah, you might get 10 pounds off of that kid. But you have screwed them up for life. You know, they're weighing in Australia. I don't know if they're doing it here. They're weighing kids in school. And people have said to me, "Yeah, but they're not. You know, but they're doing it in a closed space where everyone can." That kid is waiting in line to be weighed with all the other skinny kids. What's that doing for that kid? How could that possibly be benefiting him? What are you going to? Makes me so angry.
I just wanted to ask you the other thing.
I have to fight it off. Okay, I'm okay. Yeah. Fuck! Just get it. I'm sorry.
The thing you said at the beginning about the three phases of consciousness was really, I've never heard anybody articulate it.
Oh, okay.
And
thanks.
I was wondering if, basically by losing all that weight, you transform all of that physical substance into what?
Spirit. It's just sublimation, I guess you could call it. Maybe. I don't know.
But, I mean, did you notice, did you feel...
Yes, I did.
...that there was a...
Yes.
...transformation?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. She asked it.
What about you speak with your body?
I'm sorry?
What about you speak with your body? I didn't
understand. It's just by... Well, okay, what language do you speak?
French.
Okay, so say that you just spoke French, you didn't speak English, okay? Just imagine that for a minute, okay? And you have to go to the bathroom, okay? And you're coming up to me. And so you can ask me in French where the bathroom is. Go ahead and ask me. Yeah. You asked me a different question. Actually, I did get that. I wanted you to ask me where the bathroom was, and I wanted to say to you, I don't know where the bathroom is. And then I was going to ask you to draw a picture of a bathroom, and I was going to say that I could tell you where the bathroom is.
Okay.
My whole point is that a visualization, you communicate with people that don't speak the same language with you with symbols. Symbols are the universal language. So a vision of your body is a symbol, and you can use it to communicate with your body. That was the point I wanted to make. Oh, visualizing your ideal body. Did I not make that clear? Visualizing the exact body that you would like to have. To have that. to have that image. Yeah.
I was wondering if you, in this process, before you started losing the weight, did you quit your job on Wall Street?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, what
yes.
Do you
yes.
Do you want to tell me the story of
what? I don't think we have time. But
the guy.
That was significant to my mind.
What's that?
To me, that would be obscene to the history.
Yeah, you should.
Which story am I telling? I was scheduled to fly out to San Francisco on September 11th, I live in New Jersey, and I've flown out to San Francisco. Whenever I do, I always fly from Newark to San Francisco on United Airlines because it's nonstop, and there's only two, and you don't have to go through New York, and there's only two. There's a morning flight and an evening flight. And I didn't want to take the evening flight because that gets you in 3 o'clock. Yeah, so that's the flight I always take. And that's the flight I would have taken. I was at a Qi Kung for weight loss seminar at the time that we had booked this flight. And I said to my partner, not that partner I'm talking about here, a different partner who's actually been my guardian angel in human form for 20 years, I said, make the flight arrangements. And I just assumed he was going to give me that flight. He found a cheaper flight from LaGuardia that connects through Cincinnati and has a 5-hour stopover, and we saved $150. And I was so mad at him for making me go through that. And it was the only time in 20 years I've ever been mad at him. But in the end, he saved my life because I would have gotten on the United Airlines Flight 93. And so when that happened, that sort of affected me in a kind of radical way because I felt like here I was trying to kill myself and living this life that, you know, I was living for the future, basically, you know, the someday type of thing. Not following my heart, not listening to my heart, not happy really. And all of a sudden, I could have died and I didn't. You know, the universe gave me a second chance and I felt that it had to be for a reason. I wasn't going to just continue to waste my life, not living my heart, not following my heart. And I had, it had been my dream to move to Western Australia, a town that I had fallen in love with, and I actually bought a house there a few years ago, and it had been my dream to do it, and I just got on the computer and bought 2 1-way tickets, and I said it's time to go. And then two weeks later, I found out my wife was pregnant. So you know, here we were going with a pregnant wife, and not knowing what I was going to do for the rest of my life. But I had to just start following my heart. That's what I knew. And so far, I've just continued to live my life that way. That just follow my heart and have everything work out. And I guess it'd be an understatement to say it was the best thing I've ever done in my life. But that is something I do talk about in the book, and more than anything, you know, to follow your heart. You know, because that always puts you exactly where you need to be on your path. Because your heart is your intuition, and it knows the future. Your mind, it makes sense. Yes, it makes sense that if I stay here, and then in 3 years I can do this, and in next year, I can, that makes sense. But you never know what's around the corner. You don't know if a piano is going to fall on your head if you go this way or that way. Your heart does. All of a sudden, you might say, maybe I'll go this way today. And you find if you were going that way, you know, piano would have fallen in your head. So your heart knows that. Your heart can see the future. And your heart knows why you're here. And your heart knows what your path is. You know, so always follow your heart.
I came to this session totally from a feeling from my heart. My mind was leading me to another doorway.
Okay.
Thanks. So thank you.
Thanks, everybody.